We have a couple of guests with us this morning to talk about railroads. It's part of a four presentation series being offered by Josephine Community Libraries. It's called All Aboard, and the series is facilitated by railroad historian Robert Herning, part of the Literary Extension Program there. Good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning, Milt.
And also joining us today, Carolyn Cohn, a volunteer with Josephine Libraries. You specifically deal with the children's program a lot, don't you?
Yes, I'm a reader. I read every month, and I get my grandma fix. and I love children in our community, so I'm helping to coordinate this program.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about what the program is going to entail. I notice, as we mentioned, there's four in the series dealing with different topics. Robert?
I've been concentrating on three of the four here from a more than just romance of the rails point of view. I want to have some basic information about railroads and railroading. The first one will be about railroads and the Rogue Valley, the past, the present, and maybe even the future. We'll be getting into the O&C, which has dominated the economy of the Southern Oregon here, and we hear about it quite a bit. Then I'm going to concentrate on the second of the three, on the Great American Railroad, which will be a broader view of the ascendancy of the railroad, and then the decline, and then the rebirth. Then, of course, the transcontinental being a major portion of that series, and then what happened in the 1970s and since then. And then finally, my third major one would be the where do the tracks grow and where do the tracks go and how do the trains run, operations. I have a lot to say about that. I've kind of watched the signals over the years and talk to railroaders whenever I get a chance, buttonhole a engineer or a conductor and ask them how the brakes work and what do the signals mean and so on.
I wanted to ask you, Robert, obviously you love trains. In your bio, it says here that you've crossed the U.S. 26 times by rail, or is it 26 and counting at this point in time?
26 and counting.
26 and counting. Where did your love of railroads come from?
That's a good question. I think that probably a lot of us, who we call ourselves rail fans, by the way. The public calls us rail buffs, and the railroaders call us foamers, because we foam at the mouth when we see a train, I guess. At any rate, I think it has to do with being introduced at a very young age by my family members to trains and riding trains. But I think it's also how they move, how a train moves. And I've been thinking about it. When we see a snake, the way the snake moves, we're immediately looking at how it moves. And that's the way a train is to me. And then from there, it blossoms into the business of railroading, the operations of railroading. When you spend a lifetime at it, you pretty much anything that has to do with it, you're attracted to.
Carolyn, how did the Josephine County Library get involved in this?
Well, we were looking for some intergenerational programs. And again, as part of the Literacy Extension Program, we want something that's entertaining and engaging and enriching. And one of the things we were considering were trains, because we knew of Robert's avocation on this subject. And then also in January, we saw the cover story about Tunnel 13 here on the Jefferson Monthly. And we said, you know, this is a real interesting, exciting topic that we can look at providing information for all generations. So we set on it.
And for folks who are interested in that, how do they find out more about that?
Well, they can go on the library website, the Josephine Community Library website, which is josephinelibrary.org. And it's on the front, on the homepage, and you can click on a link to all the scheduled programs for the dates and the times. They're all on Sundays from 2 to 4. The first one is May 4th. And we are also coordinating with the Medford Railroad Park, because they are every other Sunday. So in May, folks can go one Sunday to our program, another Sunday to the railroad park, and I think their hours are 11 to 3. So it's going to be a fun month on Sundays for families.
If you'd like to join our discussion today, the toll-free number, 800-838-3760, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. On the line, we have Grumpy John from Grants Pass. Go ahead.
Well, I have two questions. One is about the romance of the rails, and the other is a practical one. I would like you to discuss the reality of hobos and if they exist today. And the second one is, I live close to a railroad right-of-way, and they dump massive, incredible amounts of toxic stuff to keep plants from growing. Is there any way to rein in the massive spraying of herbicides that they freely gush onto our roadways and into our waterways? So hobos and toxic stuff that they are free to just dump on us. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Well, I'd like to talk first about the toxic chemicals. Yeah, I've worried about that, too, a lot. They do dump massive amounts of it, and being that railroads are private land, private enterprises, there's not a lot that can be done other than through the Environmental Protection Agency and the laws we have about such matters. I've worried about that also. And I really don't know a lot about the subject, except that what I've seen and observed, as you mentioned. About hobos? Oh, yeah. There's plenty of hobos out there. There probably were more during the 1930s, and I myself was out there in the 1970s. I went out at least 10 times for long trips on freight trains. By the way, hobos don't call themselves hobos. They call themselves tramps. Everybody who's in it is as a tramp. And I know from a young man who's been a friend of mine for a while who wanted to go out and do it, and last summer he did. And so he's brought me up to date, and there are plenty of tramps out there still. Unfortunately for tramps, there's a lot of video cameras and a lot more security things after 9/11, so you have to be much more careful. In the 1970s, it was like hitchhiking with no problem whatsoever. Now, you have to be very careful that you don't get caught because things happen to you. When I was out there, it was no problem, even from railroad police, who would usually just take your name and let you go.
I'd like to ask you about sort of the importance of railroads in this area, in Southern Oregon and Northern California, back in the day, especially before we had I-5 and such a road network. How vital was it, and what kind of things did the railroad provide back in those days?
Well, the railroad came into the area from the north, originally from Portland, during the period from the 1870s into the turn of the century. And it was the main line connection when it connected to the Central Pacific, which came up from California. Unfortunately, due to some problems in financing, it was finished rapidly and with excessive grades and very, very tight corners and over the Siskiyous south of Ashland, and it never was in a position to be a main line, so that in the future, when the Southern Pacific could connect to Eugene through Klamath Falls, we became a backwater here. And once I-5 was built, it pretty much took all the through freight out of here.
Is there a resurgence in interest in railroads? Certain groups, I imagine kids always love railroads, don't they?
Yes.
But just as a society, are we seeing more interest in railroads these days?
Well, there's been a tremendous resurgence in railroads. It's an industry that almost died, and it turned itself around to become a very vital part of our American economy. So there's an interest there. If you look at the stock market, the Union Pacific, which is one of the major railroads, the stock was trading in the 10 years ago about in the 30s, and now it's 187 as of yesterday.
And does the future look good, especially for freight and that kind of commerce? Is it? I've always heard about these battles may be the wrong word, but you have trucking versus hauling freight by trains. What's the status on that?
The container changed everything. The container changed railroading, and the ability to stack one on top of the other meant that the ability to move freight cheaply compared to trucks lost the battle. The trucks won the battle for a while, but the container changed that. Also in 1980, the Staggers Act changed railroading forever again when it was the Interstate Commerce Commission was abolished and freight rates were changed. At that time, railroads' rates were regulated very heavily, and after the Staggers Act, the rates, what it cost to ship, declined tremendously. Yeah. And it allowed the shippers to make contracts with the railroads. This allowed for unit trains, trains of solid grain, oil, coal, containers, and they didn't have to sort a lot of loose cars, which took forever. So for a car to go across the continent may have taken at that time 4 weeks by going from yard to yard and being reclassified. A solid train from Long Beach to Little Ferry, New Jersey would be 72 hours maybe.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask Carolyn, because you work with trying to interest children in literacy and different topics, how do you put something like this together to interest the kids?
Well, we're going to have on the September 14th program, which is the tickets for the whole family, we're going to be separating the kids out and looking at different books, having stories read by rail fans and in conductor hats. And the current Caldecott medal winner is one on locomotives. Mm. And it is phenomenal, and it has such depth to it as well as beautiful illustrations. That is a perfect starting point. We have other books that we've read and other events that will be happening that day, and then the parents and other adults will be able to hear more about travel on trains, international travel, and that kind of thing. So we're going to, again, have something for everyone in this series.
Sounds fun. If you have a question, give us a call at 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. We have Boyd on the line from Wolf Creek. Go ahead, Boyd.
Good morning from Wolf Creek. One of the branch libraries. I had 2 points. One, the current opportunity to ride passenger trains, worth highlighting, going north from Eugene, the Cascades leaves several times a day. I'd recommend that. It's inexpensive and enjoyable. And number two, I'd hope in the cultural history you'd highlight the presence of Chinese labor here in Wolf Creek. A crew helped build the tunnel between Wolf Creek and Glendale.
Yeah, that brings up a question. Thank you, Boyd. I was going to ask, you know, especially for families who've never been on a train, the kids have never been on a train, and mom and dad would like to introduce them to a ride or something. Is there a couple of little short trips appropriate for kids around here that you could recommend?
Well, the nearest passenger service is Klamath Falls. Actually, from Klamath Falls to Eugene, it's a possible round trip in a day. It would work out very well. You have to be there pretty early. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning northbound and about 10 o'clock southbound to return. But it's doable in a day out of Klamath Falls and very beautiful scenic route. So I would recommend that one. In fact, the two Coast Starlights meet each other near Salem, so it could even be maybe Albany or Salem where you change, but certainly, Eugene. That's the most scenic section anyway.
I want to ask a little bit about O&C funds mm-hmm. and how they played into the railroad's history.
Well, the O&C fund has to do with the land grant that was awarded to the O&C Railroad when it was built south. The O&C Railroad, unfortunately, had serious financial problems due mostly to mismanagement and robbery on the part of their executives. Around the turn of the century, the government found there was so much corruption that they took the land grant back. Hmm. When they took the land grant back, it meant that a huge amount of land was taken out of the tax base for the six ONC counties that are south of Eugene, and that this had a huge amount of timber on it and was going to be private land that would be paying taxes. The counties squawked about it, and the railroad, actually the railroad went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court eventually ruled in favor of the Southern Pacific, allowing them to have the what they should have had, $2.50 per acre, but the government never returned the land to the private sector. So it was agreed that half of the stumpage, half of the timber value, would go to the counties directly. It was amended, I think, to 30% or 25% at a later date. And this was great because it was unlimited timber forever, but there wasn't.
No, that proved out, didn't it?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, you've also ridden rail lines outside of the United States as well. And if you have any thoughts, any comparisons to how other railroads are, I imagine there's some really good ones and some that maybe are pretty bad. But if you had any thoughts on that compared to our rail lines.
Well, during the 1980s and 90s, I rode a lot of Mexican trains because they were the hand-me-downs from the American Great Limiteds that had been running through the U.S. And when passenger railroads declined during that period due to the interstate highways and jet planes, everything was on a yard sale sent down to Mexico. So I got a chance to ride those, but crews of guys would get on periodically and tighten all the Phillips head screws and put in light bulbs, maybe.
Maybe.
So that's one. But on the other hand, European trains are excellent. And I've ridden the Trans-Siberian Railway, which is in 12 days of travel in one direction on one train, from the Sea of Japan to the Baltic. And the Russian state railways are very, very well run. Most of the railways of the world are not private. Most of them are railways that are run by or built by the government. And in Europe, you may have the Czech state railways or the French national railways or the German Bundesbahn and so on. And these are funded by essentially gas taxes. And when you buy gasoline in Europe, you pay $5 a gallon tax before you pay for the gas. $5 a gallon. This goes to airports, highways, and railroads.
I was also going to ask how efficient railroads or what am I trying to say, engines, I guess, are today. I mean, are we still manufacturing new engines or some of the technology change that we see with automobiles and airplanes? Are we seeing that in railroads as well?
Certainly. In diesel-electric locomotives, incidentally, diesels are not a diesel engine like a truck. A diesel locomotive runs an electric motor, and the electric motor runs the train. So the changes that are going down now, right at the present, are changing to natural gas, which looks like an enormous savings. It's been calculated that changing over to natural gas, liquefied or just regular gas under pressure, would save enough to pay for itself in 1 year.
Wow.
So Burlington Northern Santa Fe is changing over a lot of their units now. Also, electric locomotives are much more efficient to operate off a catenary wire and have a better configuration of starting and stopping. So it's much better for passenger service if you can put the infrastructure in.
All right. Well, Carolyn, I'd like you to, in the little time we have left, to tell us a little bit about the All Aboard dates and times, and especially how someone could go to the website or find out more information so they can put this on their calendar to participate.
Great. The kickoff is Sunday, May 4th, and it's from 2 to 4 at the main branch of the library, and that's our Station 1 about focusing on the Rogue Valley. The next one is 2 weeks later, May 18th, again on a Sunday from 2 to 4, and that's focusing on the bigger picture, the Great American Railroad. The third one is we're skipping to the fall, and that's September 14th, another Sunday from 2 to 4, and that's the tickets for the whole family. And so that's where we'll have kids' activities and we'll have the romance of the railroad. And then the last one is on Sunday, October 12th. And that will be going talking more about the infrastructure and some of the innovations that were created because of the trains, you know, as far as keeping time and all that. That's fascinating information. In order to get more information, they can go to our website, josephinelibrary.org. And there'll be a link there to the schedule and event. And then also, if someone wants to call, they can call our person, Roberta Lee, who's in charge at, of this event, of these events. Her number is 541-592-4778. Thank you very much. We look forward to getting everybody aboard, all aboard.
And I'm a big fan of libraries myself, so let me give you another chance to give a pitch for the Josephine Library System and maybe some other things you offer outside of trains at this train series that people are not aware of.
Oh, we have meeting room space. It's a community center, each of these libraries that people come to, and lots of different groups and events. We run with over 200 volunteers that help, such as Robert and myself, and have, you know, a big presence, increasing number of library card holders, 300 more each month, so it's growing. We're having more the story time that I read at. We now have over 30 kids each time, and years ago it was only like 8 or 10. So we're really growing and getting more support, and right now we're funded just with donations and grants, and a grant is helping fund this from the Oregon Humanities. And so we're looking to get more and more people involved.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank our guests who have been here today, Robert Herning, a train historian and a fan of that, and Carolyn Cohn from the Josephine County Library, a volunteer there who deals with children's programs and things like that, and long live trains and libraries. I hope they're around both a long time.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks you for joining us today on The Exchange. Coming up next, we'll be talking with Ed Polish of Ashland's Bad Film Society. But first, Garrison Keillor with today's edition of the Writer's Almanac right after this short break.